The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPont.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Infectious diseases are disorders caused by pathogens such as bacteria, viruses, fungi, or parasites, and they're on the rise. In 2050, infectious diseases could surpass heart disease as the world's number one killer. They could also create healthcare costs of at least $100 trillion. Why are infectious diseases rising? How can we protect ourselves against them? Who is most at risk, and what do you need to know to protect yourself and your loved ones? There's lots of ways for you to get into our conversation. You can call us at 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to the source at tpr.org and tweet at us at tprsource. We're joined this hour by Dr. Larry Schlesinger. He's the president and CEO of Texas Biomedical Research Institute. Dr. Anita Curran is the Assistant Director for the Communicable Disease Division at the San Antonio Metropolitan Health Department, and Dr. Lise Ann Perofsky is the Head of the Infectious Disease Division at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. Welcome, all of you, this hour. And so let me go first to Dr. Perofsky to talk about infectious diseases. And while this is a category, this is a massive category, it's really hard to kind of wrap your arms completely around what infectious diseases are and how what they can do to us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's really an honor to be on your show and to be asked such a deep question. So infectious diseases are diseases that are caused by microbes. They can have many different manifestations clinically. And they can be caused, as you mentioned in your introduction, by different classes of microbes, including, as you mentioned, bacteria, fungi, and viruses. The important thing, actually, for your program today, I think, is for people to understand that we largely live in harmony with microbes. We're learning more and more that they're actually an important part of our bodies and of our normal physiology. But there are interactions with these microbes that result in disease. And that is really what infectious diseases are. And I think that we could break them into a couple of important categories for the discussion today. So some are caused by microbes that we acquire from other people. And examples of that would be measles, which you mentioned, and also tuberculosis would be another very good example. And then we have categories of microbes that we acquire from the environment. And a good example there would be Legionella, Legionnaires' disease. And then we have a very large category of infectious diseases that we actually acquire from ourselves. And your mention of the antibiotic-resistant bacteria falls into a couple of these categories. So it includes the organisms that we have within ourselves. When something goes wrong with us, we have surgery, we get put on medications that alter our immune system, and suddenly one of our friends becomes our enemy and can cause disease. Some of these organisms, the antibiotic-resistant organisms, can also be acquired in the hospital from other people and also from the environment. So I think the important point to begin the discussion is that, in general, something has to happen for an infectious disease to occur, either from acquisition or some sort of perturbation in the environment or a perturbation in the immune system of people.
So we received this email from one of the listeners as we heard a promo, and he wrote us an email this morning. He says he's a 60-year-old male, hasn't been admitted to the hospital since he was 5 years old to get his tonsils out. Then last April, he thought he had the flu, went to the ER. They discharged him because he tested negative for the flu. And then his fevers kept going up. He got a 104-degree fever. Finally went back to the hospital. He was admitted into intensive care for 2 days, still undiagnosed. But then he was finally figured out that they brought in an infectious disease specialist 3 days later. And he was able to detect that this guy had typhus. And so they changed the antibiotic, cocktail they were giving this guy, and they were able to treat him. But still, he was for another 10 days, he was home trying to recover from all of this. And he had this massive hospital bill as well. So this email, and I thank Jim for sending it to us, I think it brings up a lot of interesting points. Number one, we're seeing the rise of more of these diseases like typhus that we thought were not something that we would typically see here in the San Antonio area. We saw that this was a very difficult thing to diagnose at the ER. And also we saw how expensive this is. I didn't tell you how much it cost, but it cost, it was eyeballs going, whoa, this is expensive for this guy. So there's a lot of elements that we're seeing in this one individual. And then we multiply that out throughout our community, and we see just how important this topic is and how we have to get a handle on it. So let me go to Dr. Curran with the San Antonio Metropolitan Health Department. And are we seeing more and more instances? Because I know I got typhoid fever, and I had to go to the hospital and get the ER, and it's very similar to this as well. But I got mine when I was in Honduras. Mm-hmm. So is that something that we're going to be seeing?
Well, this gentleman is talking about typhus fever. Typhoid fever, typhus is different from typhoid fever.
Sure.
And yes, we do see cases of typhus fever here in Bexar County as well. On an average, we see anywhere from, on a good year, on a bad year, 50 to about 150 cases of typhus, which is typically a flea-borne or a tick-borne disease. Yes, it is commonly seen, and yes, it is often misdiagnosed because we are not aware of these infections, and so we go to the usual suspects when a person presents with fever, rash, joint pain. You know, the symptoms are pretty nonspecific, can mimic hundreds and different types of infectious
diseases. You always
have
the fever, the diarrhea, the fatigue, muscle ache, the coughing,
joint pain, rash.
What is that?
Exactly.
You know? That's
exactly
why we need better diagnostic tools. So I'm wondering, Dr. Schlesinger over at Texas Biomed, if that's on your list of the things that you want to come up with.
Oh, there's no question about it. I think this case brings up a lot of points like you mentioned. One that I would bring up is there's a paradigm that I'd like everyone out listening to understand, which is often we have a genetic predisposition, let's say, to a type of illness or a disease, and then there's what we call a second hit, which often is an infection. And that infection can trigger the immune system response, which leads to something called inflammation. And that inflammation is very hard to get over, and that's the prolonged illness that you heard about in the patient today. And understanding how the immune system responds is part of the solution to the problem, because I think that as we understand how infections occur, that will help us improve our diagnostic capabilities. It will improve our approaches to therapies, which are critically needed, particularly for these multidrug-resistant pathogens. So this is definitely a critical part of the new transformation of Texas Biomed, which is really strategically going forward, putting all of its energy in the sciences of infectious disease in vulnerable populations.
We're going to take a break. When I come back, I want to hear more about how Texas Biomed is reinventing itself and going to take a deep dive, laser focus on infectious diseases. Why is that? What does that mean? Why is this really like they're answering the emergency siren that something has to be done? Got a question or a comment, call in. The number is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the rise of infectious diseases. And this has become something that has caught the attention of the world. Something needs to be done, needs to be taken more seriously. We know that we've had epidemics in the past. It was about 100 years ago that we had the Spanish flu epidemic here in Texas and across the world. It wiped out quite a number of people. If we're not careful, things like that could happen again. That's why we have to invest in science and be sure to wash your hands, things like that. Let's go to the phones, 210-614-8980 with Jordan. And Jordan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thanks. So I just wanted to say that TBRI is an incredible world-renowned institution. I think it's the only BSL-4 lab that's privately owned in America, and they do some really innovative things. San Antonio leads the way not only from that, but we also have a component of DSHS that deals with high-consequence infectious disease response. It's called the Emergency Medical Task Force's Infectious Disease Response Unit, or the IDRU, and it is tasked with responding to high-consequence infectious diseases in a pre-hospital setting and then the hospital augmentation of care for patients with high-consequence infectious diseases like Ebola. And I think it's just time for us, San Antonio, to take a victory lap with some of the amazing things that we do here.
All right, Jordan, thank you for the call. So Dr. Larry Schlesinger, he's saying some good things about your facility out there. So he mentioned that you have this high-level containment area. What is that?
Yeah, so there are four levels of biosafety laboratories that step up the amount of seriousness of the infection and whether there's therapy. The biocontainment level four facilities are really to work with infectious agents safely, and I want to emphasize safely, for which there's no therapy. So there's a lot of, in engineering controls and other things that need to be into that facility. Texas Biomed has had one for 19 years. It's the only privately owned biocontainment level 4 facility in the country. It runs really well. We have a very good reputation. And we also do, within that facility, regulated science, which is what's required by the FDA to bring new, let's say, drugs and vaccines to market. And combined with that, we're one of the seven national primate research centers, which enables us to use and work with an animal model that is extremely important in our ability to predict human responses, that is the non-human primates, and they're in the facility, and we're doing some very impactful science within those types of facilities.
So walk us through what the thinking was when Texas Biomed, where you were doing all sorts of research, very instrumental in coming up with the cure for hepatitis C, working on Ebola as well there. You're saying we're doing a lot of work in infectious diseases. This is really where we've got to put all our marbles.
Yeah. I've been involved in the arena, clinical and research-wise, in infectious diseases for well over 30 years now. Had the opportunity to come to San Antonio because of what I saw in Texas Biomed, a 78-year-old institute that's made major discoveries over the decades, but as you say, hasn't really been an external face institution for all the things that we do. And it turns out that the majority of what we've been doing is working on diagnostics, therapies, and vaccines for infection. And as a result of a strategic planning process, we are now transforming the institute. And we want the world to know that we're going to dedicate all our resources to protecting you, your family, and the global society, vulnerable populations, from the threat of infectious diseases, which has already been brought up by Dr. Perofsky and others here, that is a critical area of health and disease for humans going forward over the next decades.
So, Dr. Perofsky, we are hearing that this rise in infectious diseases, what's behind that?
Okay. Before I get to that, I would like to just comment that the patient case that we just heard, that when your listeners or your family members have fevers or chills and they don't know what is going on with them, infectious disease consultation makes a really, really big difference. And I probably should have stated in the opening that an infectious disease consult, being called for fever or some other poorly understood clinical manifestation, really saves lives and saves money and really helps us understand what's going on. As far as the rise in infectious disease that you're referring to, the drivers of this are many. You mentioned the measles, the rise in measles, which we have very clearly can attribute to vaccine refusal and for a very insufficient number of vaccinated people. For vaccines to work, we need something called herd immunity, which means that a very large proportion of a community needs to be immune or immunized in order to protect, as Dr. Schlesinger pointed out, vulnerable populations. So when the immunity in the community drops below a certain level, then anybody who is susceptible will develop disease with an organism like measles, because it is very virulent and able to cause disease in people that are not immune. But other factors that are contributing to the rise in infectious disease are global travel. We are seeing the importation of arboviruses or mosquito-borne viruses from people who have traveled from areas where those viruses are endemic. The arrival of Zika virus to the Americas was felt to come with the World Cup from Barcelona many years ago. So the our world being global and people being able to travel between places and travel when they're sick or bring mosquitoes is a factor. And then another factor is the environment and the changes in our climate, the changes in our terrain. An example of that would be outbreaks of fungal disease that have occurred in California as a result of El Nino or in the Southwest because of the changes that have occurred in part due to sort of urbanization and mixing up the environment. And people should not interpret these events as indictments of any of these things. We don't want to stop traveling and we don't want to stop working on our environment, but they should be recognized as factors that make the likelihood of certain types of infectious diseases higher. And it's really on us, those great new diagnostics that Dr. Schlesinger is talking about, or on us as infectious disease consultants to really be on the front lines of public health and anticipate when it's possible that certain infectious diseases may be emerging.
So Dr. Curie-Ann with the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District, we talked about herd immunity, and some people are using the word community immunity more often to try to stress the fact that this is the community. How are we doing here locally? I know that we are seeing measles in parts of Texas.
So locally, if you look at the childhood series, we are doing pretty good. We are doing better than the state and the national estimates. In the United States, most recent data is 76%, or I should say 70, close to 70% of children were vaccinated with all seven combined vaccine series that protect a kid from 14 different infectious diseases. Here in San Antonio, the combined seven series for these childhood vaccinations was estimated to be at 76%. So we're doing pretty good. As far as measles go, we have a good coverage with measles too. But the problem is, like my colleague was stating earlier, is that most of the measles cases that we are seeing here locally are imported cases. These are folks either traveling to endemic areas. We've eliminated measles here in the United States in 2000, but we have not eliminated measles worldwide. So as long as measles exist globally, there is a risk of this infection being imported here in our community where we have good vaccine coverage as well. So most of the recent outbreaks that we've seen, be it the 2018 outbreak or the 2017, 2015, 2016, if you look at those outbreaks, they were specifically seen in the unvaccinated segments of the population where measles could spread like wildfire. So measles, like I said earlier, it's highly infectious. 90% of 9 out of 10 folks who are unvaccinated who come in contact with a person who's infected with measles can get the disease. So we see a rapid spread of this measles in this tiny unvaccinated segments of population. And even though the measles vaccine is highly effective, it's 97% effective if you have received the two doses of measles vaccine. Yet when the herd immunity goes down and measles is spreading in the community among the unvaccinated population, we tend to see even among fully vaccinated, there can be breakthrough infections that can occur in every 3 to 4 person in 100 populations.
But we have people in our community who are born with have immunity problems, and they cannot take a vaccination.
Sure.
So what we want to do is we want to protect those individuals from coming in contact with this incredibly contagious virus by get everyone who is healthy enough to get a vaccination. Yes. Should get a vaccination.
Yeah, and that's what in a public health world we use the term cocoon. We create a cocoon of safe environment around folks who cannot get vaccinated.
And but we know though that we're also one of the reasons why we're seeing this rise in infectious diseases. Does this have anything to do with the antibiotic resistant infections, Dr. Schlesinger?
Antibiotic resistance permeates a lot of our discussion today and has a major economic cost in the United States and worldwide.
This is a nightmare thing.
This is a nightmare thing. It's something that, on the other hand, I want to come back and, as Dr. Porofsky said, we're not here to scare people further. But the truth is we're losing our therapeutic armamentarium against a variety of infections. And it's really important that we think about new approaches to therapy. And I think there's some excitement around the corner with regard to that. I think one of the kind of breakthroughs in the field of infectious diseases that I think is important is that historically we've created therapies that are directed against the microbe directly. And microbes evolve and they become resistant and they become a lot more resistant than humans. But taking from the cancer field, where, in fact, the Nobel Prize awarded just a few months ago, this immunotherapy concept was the idea that cancer cells and infections can actually suppress our immune response and take the upper hand. So one of the approaches might be to bolster the immune system along with antibiotics against the microbe. And this in infectious diseases is called host-directed therapies. And there's more attention to this based on our increasing knowledge about how our body responds to various infections. So I think taking new approaches to therapy is going to be helpful here to get over the major growing problem of drug resistance for local infections like bacterial sepsis, which affects our families in hospitals, to global infectious threats like tuberculosis.
And hospital infections tend to be really difficult because those are the ones that are, they're on steroids almost.
Yeah, hospital infections are a major problem in this country, well, worldwide, and particularly in our intensive care units. That's where you see a lot of people who are immunocompromised. They have various plastics in their body as a result of keeping them alive, so we break the skin barriers. And the organisms they tend to get are more resistant. So you have kind of a plethora of reasons why ridding that infection becomes so difficult.
So we know that trying to figure out ways to fight infections can mean better training when dealing with catheters and things like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah, healthcare practices in general. So this spans, as you said at the beginning of the show, a very broad field. But I think that all the elements are critical for the community to know about. So the kinds of steps being done in hospitals to protect us against transmission, healthcare workers, washing hands. I mean, this all plays into it. And I think we owe it to the community to do more shows like this, to be able to educate and communicate with the community to know about this problem. Infection, if I might just conclude, infection goes much broader than infectious diseases because we know that with the host response to an infection, one might trigger that inflammatory response, which, for example, can lead to cardiovascular disease, can trigger cancers. Just yesterday, we had a program on liver cancer, which is very significantly associated with hepatitis B and C. So the links between infection, autoimmune diseases, inflammatory bowel diseases is also something we need to talk about.
What do you want to know about the rise of infectious diseases? Do you have a personal experience story to share? You can be anonymous. Do you have a question about how to protect yourself and your family from infections, also including bug bites, animal bites? It's all part of the deal. Give us a call, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Bacteria, viruses, fungi, parasites, these are all things that cause infectious diseases. Although they're very different and do different things to the body, we've got to come up with ways to figure out how to keep them in check, because projections tell us that by 2050, infectious diseases could be the number one killer, surpassing heart disease. What do you want to know about how to keep infectious diseases at bay in your home? 210-614-8980. And Justin is on the line. Hi, Justin. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to say I think it's important that the different perspectives from the doctors are being shown. I think it's really important that there's this new emerging science in microorganisms and how we're understanding that they're really important and essential for our immune system, and versus, you know, this other type of belief system of antibiotics and vaccinations that are progressively becoming more and more needed. It seems like we have an epidemic of antibiotics that's, you know, worldwide worse than opioids. And, you know, I think it's important that there's these different belief systems and different new sciences that are out there.
Justin, thank you for the call. Dr. Lizanne Porofsky, head of Infectious Disease Division at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, can you talk about, you know, we've got good critters and bad critters in our system, the microbiome, and they all help us to digest, and they also deal with, help us keep us healthy as well. So how do we take care of one while fighting off others?
Well, that's a really great question and a very perceptive point by your caller. One of the things that has clearly altered the good bacteria that live in us, and probably fungi and viruses as well, has been the overuse of antimicrobial agents or antibiotics. So the problem is really twofold. One is for the individual. So as Dr. Schlesinger was mentioning, patients who are in the hospital who are treated with antibiotics, often because they need them, can develop resistant organisms, which then can be spread to other patients. But we also have the larger problem of very rampant use of antibiotics in our country and elsewhere for indications that are really increasingly becoming very questionable. So one of those is when someone goes to the dentist, in the absence of having a abnormal heart valve or something like that, oftentimes patient go to the dentist, gets a little pack of antibiotics to take with them. Also the many, many antibiotics that are given for colds, the common cold. And what this has done is that on both an individual and increasingly a more a community, to use your word from before, base scale, has really changed our microbiota. And there is ample evidence that antibiotics perturb those good bacteria that live in us and skew the distribution towards organisms that have the capacity to cause what Dr. Schlesinger mentioned before is inflammation. And the overuse of antibiotics has led to a kind of inflammatory state in our you know, sort of resident microbiota, the organisms that live in us, that has now being linked to an increased propensity to develop diabetes, an increased propensity to develop obesity. So that the use of antibiotics is having a much larger effect upon our population and is really very close to a public health emergency. And that is one of the reasons why many people in the research world are focusing on the host-directed therapies that Dr. Schlesinger mentioned. And I would like to point out that the first antibiotics we ever had were actually host-directed. They were antibodies that came from the serum of animals that had been immunized against various very common organisms. And we have the capacity these days to develop very safe host-directed therapies. And this is in the pipeline But one of the reasons that it's even more important is to help us kind of get back to baseline with some of the alterations that we've caused in our own microbial flora with the use of antibiotics.
So Dr. Schlesinger at the Texas Biomed, as you'll look at how to help us deal with infectious diseases in a more, in a better way, healthy way, are we looking at how to improve our overall system of being able to fight off infections, just a natural way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our institute will tackle everything from the very, what we call basic sciences, understanding molecule interactions when bugs and humans get together, to developing new strategies for diagnostics, therapies, and vaccines. And then on a population scale, looking at correlates, we call it correlates of susceptibility or resistance. What is it in the population? What are the, what's the genetic framework? What are some of the other aspects of the immune system that might make individuals susceptible on a population basis? And we really want to do what we call the whole pipeline up to preclinical studies and work with our community partners, our hospitals, et cetera, to move some of our discoveries into the clinic. The passion here is that we, as in it's been said already, we have an emerging crisis in this discipline. It influences so many other areas of health and disease. You heard about diabetes, and people talk about metabolic syndrome. So it's really critical that we start moving from reacting to, let's say, the next outbreak of a virus, to a proactive agenda where the resources become available and we have the right organizations to allow for new discoveries to be made. This is so critical for health.
And then you have the partnership with local metropolitan health districts like we have here in San Antonio. And Dr. Kurian, are you working with researchers figuring out how to implement the latest findings?
Yes, we do. I broadly categorize our response to these emerging threats into two categories. One is surveillance. So we are constantly tracking in a systematic way more information about these diseases. Who is it affecting? Where is this occurring? When is this occurring? And to identify any unusual patterns as far as transmission goes. And for example, most recent syphilis, you are seeing a high number of cases that we've ever seen in the past decade. And what we are seeing in our surveillance data is that in the past, we saw most of these cases occurring in men having sex with men. Now we are seeing a high proportion of these cases also occurring among heterosexuals and women, not just men, MSMs or IV drug users. So those findings are being communicated on a constant basis back to the researchers so they can use this information to adapt their research to this or find more new diagnostic methods or new or understand better why this is happening.
So are we constantly reevaluating what we think we know about what viruses and what they do? It used to be thought that things like the hantavirus was just a simple little virus, didn't do it. And then now we know it could actually have long-term neurological impact on people. If you live long enough, you're going to see the impact of that virus you got 20 years ago.
No, I believe it's really important point you're making in the sense that the kind of long-term consequences of an infection is what I think more and more attention is around. I was commenting earlier offline that there have been some recent papers that have linked certain viral infections to Alzheimer's disease. So science is allowing us to begin to understand the relationship between an infection and the triggering of that immune system and other diseases. And, I welcome all the opportunities to chat with the community to help them understand this better. It's not a fear factor thing, just focusing entirely on a global threat of Ebola, for example, but rather those, the flora, the microbiota that Dr. Porofsky was talking about, understanding how we work with our immune system and the bugs that are the good bugs to keep our immune system healthy. At the end of the day, diet and exercise means a lot in terms of keeping our ability to resist infection strong.
And let's go to the phones with Joan. And Joan, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that in San Antonio here, we have a, I think, very wonderful and underutilized resource We have a UT cancer researcher who has partnered with an executive chef to bring knowledge, science-based, you know, verifiable, supportable knowledge to the public about inflammation and about how the dietary choices that we make can affect inflammation, and to educate people as to how to use readily available ingredients, herbs, spices, fruits, vegetables, so forth, to help to fight chronic inflammation in their own bodies and balance the immune system. So they've done a clinical trial and are on the verge, I believe, of doing some more. And I think that this kind of knowledge the public seems to be really, really hungry for, and I would love to see them working with your experts here to help bring this knowledge to the public and to expand it.
All right. Thank you for the call, Joan. And Dr. Schlesinger, reaction?
I couldn't agree more in the sense that science is a collaborative venture. And more when we think about resources for science, it's about making those links, the links between the community, the public health officials, scientists. We must work together, and I think that's how we're going to solve the problem. One of the great things about moving to San Antonio is I'm so impressed with the engagement of the community in the healthcare and biosciences corridor. And working with our colleagues at the universities and in the private and public sector, I think we're really able to make a difference. So I agree with the caller. There are new horizons for us in science.
And Dr. Kurian, real quick, anything to add to about the diet and dealing with inflammation? Is that something really to... rings any bells?
No, I echo all the sentiments that have been expressed previously. And I think just using commonsensical preventive everyday measures goes a long way in preventing these infectious diseases.
All right. We're going to take another break. We'll come right back. We're talking about the rise of infectious diseases, how San Antonio is leading the way in coming up with some cutting edge research and also with public health concerns. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There's millions and millions of things out there right around you right now, probably crawling on your skin trying to kill you. They are infectious diseases, and thank goodness you're a healthy individual and you're able to keep them away from you or keep them in check. But sometimes those infectious diseases get stronger and you get weaker and you need some outside help. You need doctors, you need medication, and you need some bed rest in order to make sure that you're able to handle that. Infectious diseases are on the rise, and we got to make sure that everyone is ready to deal with that. Why is that? And what are the best practices for us as individuals? 210-614-8980. Let's go to the phones with Dave. And Dave, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call and question, and a great show. So I've had a hip replacement, and every time I go to the dentist, they tell me to take 4 tablets of 500 milligrams an hour before I have my dental procedure. Is that really protecting me against anything, you know, keeping me from getting an infection down in my bones, or is that creating, you know, another problem? Because generally you take, if you're doing antibiotics, you take them for 10 days. So is this really helping me, or is it a false sense of security? Thank you.
All right, Dave, thank you for the call. Let's go to Dr. Pirovsky at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine.
So that's a really important question. The use of antibiotic prophylaxis for joints, for procedures on joints, is recommended, but it's recommended to be done the way that you initially stated, to take a dose before the procedure and then generally to take one or two doses following the procedure. The recommendation, unless there are complications or a documented problem, for 10 days. So, is it helping you? Probably. The rationale is that when you have a foreign body, as you do in your hip, and somebody cuts into your skin or does some, excavation in your mouth and causes some bleeding, and the bacteria there could potentially get into your bloodstream, the rationale is that those antibiotics being there in your blood at that time will take care of those bacteria will kill them, and they will never reach your hip and infect your joint. That is the rationale for antibiotic prophylaxis, and there are a limited number, but definitely a number of instances where it is definitely indicated. But what is not indicated is in a procedure that goes well and you're fine, that you take those antibiotics beyond the one or two doses afterwards that is recommended.
So would you want that dentist to sort of lay off the penicillin pills?
Yeah, I think actually there is a big movement. As a matter of fact, I saw an abstract recently that showed that the use of antibiotics by dentists is down by 70% or some number close to that. And so the practice that some have engaged in of, cleaning your teeth, it's a very vigorous cleaning, or extracting a tooth and giving a 10-day course of antibiotics is being increasingly stopped. And antibiotics are being reserved for settings where there's actually a documented process that needs the antibiotic. And there are a number of settings in which sort of routine knee-jerk use of antibiotics is being curtailed. That's one of them. Another is in the use of antibiotics for sore throats. This is a big thing in children. And also for the common cold. Sometimes when people aren't better after a few days, there's a lot of pressure that is exerted by concerned patients, and then equally concerned doctors who want to do good by their patients to give antibiotics. And I think that that is an area where the tide is really beginning to turn. And as Dr. Schlesinger, I think, really beautifully pointed out in the first segment, that when there is a process, a viral process, the common cold, the body, in order to completely deal with that virus, will often produce a significant amount of inflammation. It's the body doing it. It is not really being driven by a lot of virus, or maybe even any virus. And so this impulse to give antibiotics in settings like that is sometimes we do it more for ourselves as doctors, to be honest with you. And I think that one of the points that is extremely important for people to recognize is that this is really calling for a behavioral change on the part of practitioners, because we always say, do no harm. And for a long time, we thought that there was no harm associated. Oh, well, we'll give 7 days of antibiotics. We'll give 10 days of antibiotics. But what we're seeing is that we are doing harm by doing that, and there's not a lot of evidence to support it. So we are trying to change our behavior.
So give them placebos? Is that something we should be doing? Dr. Schlesinger?
No, we should.
Let me get Dr. Schlesinger's reaction on that.
Yeah, sure.
No. I think the point is there is a place and a time for antibiotics, and the judicious use of antibiotics or antivirals is really what the bottom line for what we're saying, and that we're more and more studies are helping us understand how we can do less rather than doing more. I think that's the point. The point is doing less sometimes is better. I wanted to make a super quick point, a follow-up to the patient who called in. A really important point. We talked about microbiota, which are the healthy bugs that we want to keep them healthy in our body to have a proper immune system. When we have hardware in our body, that's what we call it, when you have an artificial hip, this kind of thing. It's interesting, the bugs evolve on the artificial material in what are called biofilms, and they grow as communities, and they put kind of a slime around them, and it makes it very hard to treat once there's a settled-in, deep-seated infection in that hardware. So it is a very difficult kind of infectious disease scenario that we like to avoid. So I think using the antibiotics properly is important here to try to limit that possibility from occurring.
So I joked earlier about placebos, but we do know that there is a placebo effect.
There
and
is.
We have people who have an infectious disease, and can the placebo effect? It shows you how wonderful the body is and can actually do things. I mean,
I'm not going to sit here advocating for
no, but doctors. We just know that it.
But you're right.
It's weird, right?
Well, so I think the answer is that we need to educate the behavioral change we're talking about. We need to be better at helping the community understand how their own body is their best friend to fight infection, their own body. And that antibiotics, antivirals, they just help your body do its thing. So, you know, I think that that's the way I would phrase it.
Okay, we've got an email or a Twitter from Eduardo. How do we properly dispose of antibiotics and other medications so we don't add them to dump sites and into the runoff, into the drinking water, into our streams? How does that contribute to resistant bugs out there? Do you want to take that question, Dr. Kurian?
We don't recommend dumping it, flushing it down your toilet, or dumping it in natural bodies of water. Feel free to call the health department, and we will direct you to the appropriate resources to do this.
We have weekends where you're able to take medication and have drop-off sites, and that's something that the San Antonio Waste Disposal system takes care of. If you are like hoarding antibiotics because you're afraid of the zombie apocalypse is coming, how long are these things good for?
Oh, well, my recommendation, again, I cannot stress this enough. Do not take antibiotics that are not prescribed to you. Take the antibiotics in the right dosage and duration that it is prescribed for, and do not try to hoard antibiotics for a future use, or do not try to borrow antibiotics from other family members or friends who it has been prescribed to.
I see people walking around more and more these days with masks on their face. Are they trying to protect themselves, or are they trying to protect others? Is this something that more and more people are become aware of, that this is should this be a health practice?
Health practice, we recommend masks for highly infectious conditions that are respiratory born or transmitted by cough, sneeze, like TB, for instance. So we do not routinely recommend that you walk around with masks around. But if you want to do that, that's your personal choice.
And so, Dr. Schlesinger, what is the top priority? What are y'all really looking at? What do you think needs to be demanding the most attention?
Well, let me say that, you know, eradicating an infection in the first place is the most powerful way to prevent infectious diseases. So I'm here to say that vaccines have been a breakthrough for the field of infectious disease and is the ultimate goal. When you talk about the smallpox story and what vaccines can mean, we currently have incredibly powerful, as has been mentioned by Dr. Kurian, vaccines for measles, mumps, and rubella. Vaccination is critical. So I think ultimately from a science perspective, the goal is vaccine. The problem is for a number of these infectious agents, and the one I study is tuberculosis primarily, it's really hard to get to a vaccine. So what do you do next? You basically want to make diagnoses quickly and have patients on proper therapy as quickly as possible. And you want to make sure that you're working with public health officials for any communicable infection. You really do need to evaluate contacts in the community. So I think that becomes kind of your secondary goal if you're thinking about having an impact in infectious diseases. And having said that, we're talking about local United States versus the world. And with regard to antibiotics that are out there in the world and being used indiscriminately, I mean, we have still a lot to think about with regard to the fact that there are no borders for infectious agents. They cross borders. That point has already been made. So we need to work as a global community on this, not just one country, for example.
Right. But to that point, there are other countries like Mexico where the vaccination rates are much higher than we have here in the United States. So we could actually be the ones that are, our diseases could be going to other countries
goes
the other way.
Goes both ways.
All right. I want to thank all of our guests. Thank you so much, Dr. Larry Schlesinger, President and CEO of Texas Biomed. They are turning their focus completely to infectious diseases. Dr. Anita Kurian is the Assistant Director of Communicable Diseases Division at the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District Department. And also Les Ann Pirovsky is the head of the Infectious Disease Division at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning us in.